Well, what do the NFL quarterback, Tim Tebow, Oprah Winfrey, and I have in common? It may take a couple hours to figure it out, I know. What does Tim Tebow, Oprah Winfrey, and perhaps many of you have in common as well? And that is, we tithe to God. You know, not that many Christians across society tithe anymore. There's David Ramsey, who has done some research with his statisticians, and he estimates that among evangelical Christians, that about 3% tithe. That's the lowest figure in some, perhaps, since measurement has been attempted. His findings did not mean that the other 97% disliked giving, but many people would doubt that it's possible to tithe in this society. And after all, isn't this society a big challenge? Estimated by Ramsey's group that 70% of Americans live from paycheck to paycheck. Inflation is constant at the gas pump and at the grocery store. We realize that many of us will be paying several thousand dollars a year more for the Obamacare that's been approved. Local governments need more money. Washington, D.C. wants more of our money. IRS has been beefed up to try to make sure that all money is collected. Some say we need more. Let's turn every interstate into a toll road. Let's charge money at all the state and national parks. Let's tax the internet, tax retirement, tax Social Security, tax people's savings even more. And yes, roll back tax cuts. And then on top of that, there is the unbelievable and public and private debt, those factors, the potential of losing jobs in what may appear to unfold as a looming double-dip recession. So people could say, well, it's just impossible to tithe. It's impossible to do that. That's archaic. That's old time. That's what worked back in an agrarian society when you didn't have all this taxation, you didn't have all these different government programs. It's impossible. There's one book that's on the market, written from a Christian point of view, Why Christians Should Not Tithe, quote, A History of Tithing and a Bible Paradigm for Christian Giving. Of course, they want to charge money for that. But there are several books like that that are on the market now. And it does raise a very penetrating question, and that is, can a Christian realistically tithe in this economy? Realistically, is it fair? Is God too harsh, archaic, out of touch? Does it make sense? Is it realistic? I'd like to take the afternoon here, part of it, to show what God asks His people to give in this economy. Definitely, it's not the same climate of yesteryear, of different eras and sections of time covered in the Bible. But as we look at the subject, let's immediately go over to Genesis 14 and quickly establish the fact that tithing was instituted originally. In Genesis 14, in verse 18, we'll read the following. Genesis 14, in verse 18, Abraham was a participant in a major battle to save his nephew Lot and other people in the process. In verse 18, it says, And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was a priest of the Most High God. And he blessed Abraham and said, Blessed be Abraham, or Abram at that point, before his name was changed. Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he... Abram, later Abraham, gave him tithes of all. So Abraham was one that recognized that Melchizedek was a special high priest. And with that in mind, let's turn over to Hebrews chapter 7. Hebrews chapter 7, where that same episode was described by the Apostle Paul. Hebrews 7, verses 1 through 3. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God who met Abraham, returning from the slaughter of the kings, blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, being by interpretation king of righteousness, and after that also king of Salem, which means king of peace, without father, without mother, without descendant, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. That's not describing a human being. That's describing a God, the one who became Jesus Christ, the Logos, the God of the Old Testament. He was the Melchizedek that Abraham tithed to. So that was the precedent that was established in the Bible. And Jesus Christ, from his day, said over in Matthew 23, I'll just refer to it in verse 23, when he was talking to the Sadducees and the Pharisees, Christ was saying, yes, you tithe the mint and the cumin. You tithe, you know, the small little herbal leaves. You're fanatical about that, and for show. They were doing that to be seen of men. And he says that there was hypocrisy with all of that. He said, you'll do that, and you'll swallow the camel. Strain the gnat, swallow the camel, and you'll overlook mercy and judgment and faith, the weighty matters of the law. But before he left the thought, he said, but don't leave the other undone. Don't leave the other undone. And this is Matthew 23 and verse 23. So I'll read that King James rendition. And he said, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay the tithe of the mint, the anise, and the cumin, and have omitted the weightier laws of judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought you to have done and not leave the others undone. So that I find interesting, because there was exorbitant taxation at that time. It was more, maybe much more difficult to get ahead in that society than this one, arguably, because of the oppressive taxation under the Romans, and that's why tax collectors were so unpopular, including Matthew. Now, I'd like for us to look at another familiar scripture, and it is an extremely unpopular passage to people that do not want to tithe or otherwise considered utterly impossible. And that's over in Malachi 3. But again, I've got to ask the question, does it make sense in our society? Is it possible? This is not an easy time to live and make the ends meet. Unemployment is high. Cost of everything is going up. And people can use human reasoning and say, well, there ain't no way. Typical famous Southern expression. Ain't no way. Malachi chapter 3, and verse 8. It is very, very unusual, because God makes several statements here. In chapter 3, verse 8, will a man rob God? Malachi was writing to his audience. This was just before the collapse of Judah, and probably on the heels of the fall of ancient Israel, the 10 tribes were taken away by Assyria. Nebuchadnezzar was on the verge of taking over Judah, and the people were facing heavy taxation then, and they were facing the specter of paying tribute, high taxes, to Babylon. And here God's interjecting, will a man rob God? Yes, you have robbed me. Talking to them, yeah, but you say, well, how's that possible? Answer, in tithes and offerings. And God says to them, you are cursed with a curse, for you've robbed me, even this entire nation. He expected the nation to know better. I don't know if we could expect the United States to know better, but you can ask yourself, is the United States under a blessing or a curse? With all of that enormous debt that we are saddled upon, you have to ask in the light of Proverbs 22:7, you know, he that is borrows a servant to the lender, you know, is this nation under a curse or under a blessing? It has been blessed in the past. There was a time when tithing was extant in ancient Israel under Solomon and David, when there was a active Levitical priesthood, when there was a nation that did believe in God and they did have a tithing system, and there was an abundance, there was plenty. There was a temple where there was more that was donated than could be used, and silver was accounted as nothing. It was gold that was kept track of, tallied up, is amounting to anything of any value. In other words, there was a time when Israel was closer to God, when its leadership believed and exercised tithing, and the nation was under a blessing. We don't see that today. So it's a parallel to what happened at the collapse of Israel and Judah anciently. It says that you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Verse 10, bring you all the tithes into the storehouse, that there might be meat in your own house. And here God goes out, not on a limb, because God is all-powerful. He says, prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open unto you the windows of heaven and pour out a blessing that there should not be enough room to receive it. So does that mean, at the end of verse 10, that we believe in a health and wealth gospel, that if we tithe, that money just falls out of the sky, that we just have more than we know what to do with? No. Doesn't always translate that way. But it does mean that we will have what we need. It does mean that some of the blessings may come from non-monetary sources. It does mean that we have a relationship we keep with God, and that regardless of what's going on in the economy, good or bad, favorable or unfavorable, that if we put God first and make His laws work in our lives, we will get good results. And we will stay on the mat, as it were. We will have what we need. God will take care of us. In summary, when we consider Malachi 3, there's three things that jump out. One is God challenges people to exercise faith. And to be very blunt about it, either God exists and we can trust in Him, or He's a liar, or He doesn't exist, and we're wasting our time. We're wasting our time here. We're wasting our time trying to have a spiritual relationship during the week. Of course, I don't believe that. But it's either one way or the other, because God says, prove me now herewith. Either He's true, and He means what He says, and He backs it up, or He lies, He's untrustworthy, He says, prove it out, find out, don't waste your time. If you conclude that God doesn't know what He's doing, or that He occasionally lies, then you'll know what you're dealing with. But it's important for us to know. It's important for us to be able to believe whatever He says, or else our religion is in vain. A second thing. God either will back up His... God will either back up His promises or is an unreliable failure. So the first one, He challenges people to exercise faith. Then He challenges people to find out if He'll back up His promises or not. A third aspect that also jumps out. I'm not sure if we ever considered this, but God pays very, very strict and detailed attention to what you and I do every day, every hour. I think we're so used to knowing, oh yes, God exists, He's out there. He's sort of aware of me. You know, every decision, everything we do, He has to, or else He doesn't, how can He reward us according to our works? And He loves all people, but He's very, very concerned about the elect of God, the people He's chosen and called to a certain standard of life. He wants to know that they are making those right choices on any number of subjects. And He has to pay attention. Why, if somebody decides to be in harmony with God that wasn't, God has unequivocally guaranteed, hey, I'll be with that person. I'll help that person. So if it's somebody halfway around the world that suddenly starts to obey Him on a number of different levels, God's going to immediately know of that. Pay attention to that and respond. And if these people are doing what He's asked them to do, He is bound to intervene for them. Work things out. Bless them. Start providing what they need. So these are the three challenges here. Challenging people to exercise faith, challenging people to prove whether the promises are true or not, and then God pays strict attention to all of our daily activities. So of the first of the three, am I faithful? That's the key question. Am I faithful with whatever God asked me to do if I can prove that it's applicable to me today? Hopefully we've proven God exists. Hopefully we've proven that the Ten Commandments are in force, even after Christ's crucifixion. In Hebrews chapter 11, the faith chapter we sometimes call it, in verse 6, we can read what Paul wrote. Hebrews 11, verse 6. It says, without faith, it is impossible to please God. For he that comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. What a wonderful blessing to know that God does respond. There's no such a thing as you making the right choice on any matter of God's law and putting into practice and he not pay attention or no. There'll never be a case where somebody comes up in the resurrection and says, God, you know, I tithe and you never responded to me. And the windows of heaven didn't open up, where he would say, oh, you know, you're right. I just plumb forgot. I was so busy with this other group of people and helping people over here. You don't know what it's like being God. It's really hard. But I had to do all these things and I just missed it. I'm so sorry. It doesn't work that way. God knows everything that goes on. In fact, in 2 Chronicles, I'll read this. 2 Chronicles chapter 16 and verse 7. This isn't at that time, verse 9. It says, for the eyes of the Eternal run to and fro through the whole earth to show himself strong in behalf of those whose heart is perfect toward him. There are so many places in the Bible where that is reiterated. God is paying attention. He will respond. He does, or else he's not God. Says that he's a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. And to those that are faithful, he says in Hebrews 13, we can go there in verse 5, let your conversation or conduct be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have, for God says, I will never leave nor forsake you. He doesn't leave people that are obedient to him hanging high and dry, helpless. God is a great God, and with a tiny, minute fraction of his abilities and power, he can look after the needs of all of us. But also, while we're in Hebrews, let's notice Hebrews 6 and verse 18. Hebrews 6 and verse 18. There are two immutable things that Paul addresses here. In the first one, he says, it's impossible for God to lie. And Paul wrote that in Titus 1 and verse 2. We won't turn there, but it says the same thing. It is impossible for God to lie. We're familiar with so many lies in so many sectors of our society that we can get used to the idea that, hey, maybe almost nobody tells the truth anymore. But that's not God. We can't mix that up with him. When Christ was on the earth, he said, the scripture cannot be broken. In other words, you don't find discrepancies. People have tried to create those, but they don't really exist. You can resolve all the apparent discrepancies in the Bible. There's no lasting way that you could go to one part of the Bible and say, well, God says to do this, and now he says, as far as principle, the opposite. It's true that he replaced the animal sacrifices with Jesus Christ's sacrifice, which made the covenant that we made with God even more binding. The principles stayed the same. The Sabbath hasn't changed. Our basic doctrines haven't changed, whether it's our view of the Trinity, or whether it's that God exists, or the Bible prophecy is unfolding. You know, these are things that don't change. These are things that have been absolutes overall, doctrinal foundations. And God is not going to change on that. No, Jesus Christ either. Hebrews 13:8. Yesterday, the same and forever. That's Christ. Malachi 3:6 says the same thing. God is consistent from one end of the Bible to the other. He has to be, or else he would know that we would have reason not to trust him. There was one other book that came out that says it was advocating tithing. It said, why non-tithers are poor and why Christians are rich. Well, that's not true. Some Christians are rich, some non-tithers are wealthy, and others the other opposite. The idea and the concept of tithing is not giving to get. There are times when there are monetary blessings that come back to us. There are times when people in this room have said, you know, I did tithe, I stepped out on faith in my situation. It didn't work. It didn't work on paper, but I can tell you that I had the things that I needed. And I was surprised, and I marveled. But it had to be that way in order to have it work out. Now, there are some people, and the church has recognized, that maybe been on small assistance, maybe welfare, fixed social security incomes, that the church would not expect to tithe because that is a provision for them. But there might be some gray areas or extenuating circumstances or some unusual gain that might be something to counsel about. But basically, the principle remains that for the people that God is working with, that he would want to bless them for their tithing to him. That means that if we are prudent, we will have our other needs met. It means more, I think, now than ever before, and in the future more. Because in the future, we have a great tribulation that's right around the corner. And there are going to be challenges that we have never seen. Or maybe in a long time, that would rival and perhaps exceed what some experienced in the Great Depression, the 1930s. And if we want to have the faith then, it's important for us to be building faith now. I think of the verse in Proverbs, he that faints in the day of adversity, his strength is small. That need not apply to us. But when we talk about a concept like tithing, we're talking about a mystery. And that is addition by subtraction. Addition by subtraction. Because carnally and physically, it doesn't make sense that if you have X amount of material wealth and you give some of it away, that you would be strong in a stronger position, better off financially and in other ways than you, prior to that challenge. Now, other people have made the comment, even people that are not connected with us. I can't believe how it worked out. Not that I use him as the ultimate spiritual resource, but you've heard of Glenn Beck, now famous telecaster, who had his own program. He came across the tithing question, and when he was not famous, he didn't really understand how it could have worked out for him. He said, I talked to my wife, Tanya, and I said, well, let's study it out. Let's see if it possibly makes any sense. But he wasn't totally convinced. Yet he tried it. He said, the hardest check I ever wrote in my life was the first check that I decided to use to send a tithe on. Who else has tithed? A lot of poor people, a lot of middle, wealthy people, and people in between. Andrew Carnegie, wealthiest person in the world at one point, he tithed. Bill Gates, Edward Bach, you've heard of Bach Tower over in Lake Wales. He was, a multimillionaire. John Rockefeller, founder of Standard Oil, the world's first billionaire. And you might say, oh yeah, well it's easy for those people. They were millionaires. Why? They didn't even, you know, I could, if I had millions of dollars, I could tithe a couple times. And I wouldn't even know it. I wouldn't feel it. I'd have so many hundreds of millions of dollars left over. That's not even a challenge. Well, why even use the names of these people? Because in John Rockefeller's case, he tithed from the time he was 20 years of age. I would never be able to tithe on my first $1 million if I had not tithed on that first paycheck. You know what his weekly income was? $1.50. $1.50. Now, $1.50 in 1850 went a lot further than it does today. But still, we're talking small potatoes. But he was convinced of that principle. And even his grandkids, Nelson Rockefeller, Winthrop Rockefeller, and David Rockefeller, they're heads, governors of New York State, West Virginia, and then the other was in charge of the World Bank, one of the major institutions. They said, you know, Grandpap made us tithe. He'd give us a quarter, and we had to work for it all day for it. And then we had to tithe our 2.5 cents on it. And, you know, that was ingrained in them. And yet they were blessed. I mean, they never had to worry about money. Now, one of the reasons was that these people were good businessmen. They got education. They had drive. It wasn't just that they tithe and they didn't do anything else. I like what Thomas Edison said. Blessings come to those who hustle while they wait. You know, it's important. We've talked about the 7 laws of success. It's important to work hard and to plan ahead and to get your education and so forth. And these people did it. Now, to be honest, to be objective, people like Rockefeller and Carnegie were ruthless businessmen. I mean, they were tough on the competition. If they wanted to dominate and monopolize an area, they would drop their prices so low, and they could because they worked in volume. They had the whole country that they were working with. And then local regional people said, wow, we can't keep up with those prices. So they'd allow themselves to be bought out. Now, you could call that ruthless. It was unregulated by the government for a number of decades. But I would suggest this. Carnal human nature being what it was, the competitors had the same human nature, the same ruthless inclinations. But here you had a few people that were tithing and some that weren't. And if you were God up in heaven, you may not approve of all the business practices, but standing back, who would you allow to be most successful? I think if you were bound to bless those that tithed, I think it would fall into their favor. But it's amazing how some people that made their mark on life credit the fact that tithing is a big reason why. Ben Kraft, who owns Kraft Foods, who owns the New England Patriots, worth over $1 billion, that franchise, just that alone, he said the one investment that I've made in my life that has paid constant dividends is the investment I've made to the Lord. In his case, he's up to 25% or more of everything that he earns. There was William Wrigley. Wrigley Spearman Gum. Came from Philadelphia to Chicago with a grand total of $32. And he decided to be a soap salesman. And so when he sold soap, he then decided to sell baking powder. And as an incentive, he would say, hey, if you buy my baking powder, I'll throw in 2 sticks of gum. As an incentive. And so then that seemed to be so attractive that he thought, well, maybe I should be just, don't fool with the powder, let's sell gum. And he made a fortune doing that. But he tithed. Conrad Hilton. You've heard of Hilton Hotels, Hilton Garden Inn. Conrad Hilton was a very, very wealthy man. And one of the reasons he worked hard, another, he knew the restaurant and the hotel business. On top of that, he tithed. Michael Dell, who made a couple $1,000s by the time he was 12, he believed in tithing, and he founded Dell Computer. If you've ever heard of Heinz ketchup, then you have to know that Henry Heinz in Pittsburgh, with his Heinz 57 products, tithed. So did Frank Woolworth. So does Ted Turner. You know, it's not an accident, even with their drive and their business acumen, that on top of that, boy, when you put all that together and you put God first, that things don't happen in a very favorable way. But again, the first step is sometimes the most challenging. The most challenging. And why would God additionally bless William Colgate or John Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie? One of the other reasons is that God so respects His laws. God so respects His laws. Sometimes we do, sometimes we just, oh yeah, take it for granted. Oh, Sabbath, yeah, it's here again, so forth. But for God, it's a big deal. And some people have wondered, why would God allow a resurrection to occur at the end of the book of Revelation, where people would be brought to life and then sentenced to death if they were already dead? I asked Gerald Waterhouse that question, and he said something that I thought was quite interesting. Again, the same thing. God so respects His laws. He values them. He is perfect in thinking. He says, this is the way to run a universe. These laws govern mankind perfectly. And this is what works. This is what works best. And I'm so bound to back up what I say that if Al Capone decides to tithe, I'm going to at least, I won't bless him for all the other things he did, but I will work some things out, because I'm not in love with criminality, but I'm bound to back up what I've instituted to be holy. Now, I've asked, is it possible to tithe in this society? What if you were in a society where you didn't have a job, you didn't have any money, you had no income? That's what a group of prisoners in the Gulag prison in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, faced and decided upon. They were eking out an existence. It was cold in the wintertime, terrible snow, and shivering. Not a pretty sight. And a number of these people did have a religious exposure to the Bible. And with the idle time, they were talking and thought, what if we began to tithe? Would God help us? Could it make sense in our prison economy here? What did they have to tithe on? A few said, well, we get a stale piece of bread once a week. We could tithe on that. And we get a dirty bowl of soup every day. And they looked around. They realized that if they tithe, they pooled their resources, they could give some extra bowls of soup to some of the prisoners that seemed to be struggling or were more sick than the others. So it was that's what they chose to do. And over the course of time, everybody marveled at the fact that nobody died, that the weakest ones got stronger, and the ones that sacrificed their 10%, not in robust health, but they were no worse for doing that. And so it was a deep gesture on their part, even though it seemed infinitesimally small. God worked it out. God is not a liar. He hates lying. He excoriates Satan the devil as being the father of lies. John 8:44. We talk about that in the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not bear false witness. If God commands us not to do, do you think He'll turn around and lie? It's impossible. Now, it's important that we realize that faith without works is dead. That's out of James 2. Works without faith is dead also. We can't be lazy. We can tithe, and then what do? Stand back and say, okay, make it happen, God. Well, we still have our part to play. We can't be lazy and say, oh, there's a lion in the street. Well, it's out of Proverbs. Oh, a lion in the street. I couldn't possibly get out and beat the bushes. I remember one person that I knew many, many years ago in a different part of the country. He had a reputation for being very lazy, and that's only because he was very lazy. And he got a job at a circus as a magician. He couldn't pull rabbits out of hats, but he could do a few little tricks. And he got classified as magician. And so he got laid off, and he was drawing unemployment as a classified musician. And I remember people were asking why he wasn't out looking for work, and the answer was, well, they're just not hiring right now, not hiring magicians. And since that's who I am, there's no point in looking for any other possible job. So he didn't do anything. Well, guess what? Money problems followed him. But if he had the attitude to go anywhere, and there was no recession going on at that time, he could have had the opposite attitude. Talk to a boss, look, I'll work hard. I'll learn. I'll come in on Christmas and New Year's. I'll come in every Sunday if you want. I'll even work for free for a week just to show you that I'm serious. And I'll learn on the job. I'll go anywhere, do anything, no job too big, too small. I'll hustle. I work hard. I try to get here early. I want to do what I can. Please, you think that doesn't stand out? You know, in this society, which is not that aggressive as far as trying to show initiative like that, I think that would make a huge impression. Even if the answer was no, or we're not going to hire you, they'll never forget that interview, that conversation. I'm not saying it's easy. I've had I've been self-employed for decades in this area, so I know what it is out there. But this is still a land of opportunity, the United States. The point I'm making is that we have our part to play. We have to do our part. And so works and faith together is a great combination, and asking for God's help. As I've already mentioned, when we prove that God exists in Malachi 3, and that is one way to do it, to have discover a personal relationship between your Creator and you. That's huge. That's very, very important. And you're proving God's awareness of you. Does He know your needs? Is He indifferent to them? Are you wasting your time depending on God? It's so important that we know that we're doing our part, and tithing is part of our part, and then we have every reason to expect God to intervene. There was one case where one couple had tithed, and life seemed to be moving along for a number of years. And the reason I bring this up is to underscore that God is aware of our decisions. For years, everything was stable, and then this person said, quote, I don't know what got into me, but I decided to stop tithing for 3 months to see what would happen. She said the first month went by, nothing happened. The second month went by, and our toddler got sick drinking something, and then almost died. Then one appliance broke after another. And then another time, several car problems came up, and that was a disaster. She said, in the third month, my husband got diverticulitis and severe neck pain. Instead of shopping at malls, now our shopping place was the pharmacy. And one day my husband exclaimed, honey, it seems that we're under a curse. Everything seems to be going wrong. But when they talked it over, they initiated tithing again. And she said, after that, it was like the day after a typhoon. Everything cleared up. No more doctor visits. Suddenly, last doctor visit, the shock of all shocks, the announcement, your diverticulitis has disappeared. No more doctor trips. Everything cleared up. That shows that God is aware. Whenever there's a change in what we're thinking or doing, He responds. I want to read something that I think is very penetrating about Mr. Armstrong. And I don't think people understand this particular experience. But he went through a lot of poverty for a lot of different reasons. God wanted the vanity out of him. He said there was 35 years out of the prime of his life when he had initially wanted to make $1 million, and he tried three serious attempts, and had God left him alone, maybe it would have happened. He thought he could do it in direct advertising. Then he thought he could make this miracle clay and sell it with all of its health properties. And then there was a last mad dash to become rich by putting up a network through advertising of a network of local laundries and then making that nationwide. And he had the smarts to do it. He had the experience. He had the drive, the energy, the education, the wisdom. He had it all. And by all rights, he should have done it. I mean, he should have been successful. As it turned out, he's writing here when he was King Midas in reverse and seemed like God was striking him down or allowing him to fail. It was so exasperating because he worked so hard and he knew so much. But he said, soon every laundry client except one had been forced to drop all local advertising. Instead of having a string of accounts, he said, I still had the account of one of the two largest laundries in Portland, Oregon, running an ad in the Portland Oregonian. This supplied me with $50 a month. That was his income. Now, $50 back then, 1928, 29, bought a lot more than it does today. But you'll understand what he writes next. But $50 a month was not enough to pay the house rent and provide food and clothing for our family. We began to buy beans and such food as would provide maximum bulk and nourishment on minimal cost. One time, a couple of days before I would be paid, though, we were so far behind in our rent, completely out of groceries except for some macaroni. The children were crying with hunger. That is gut-wrenching to a parent. My stomach gnawed with pain. Like old Mother Hubbard, our cupboards were bare. Save for a little macaroni. But there was no cheese or any ingredients used for baking macaroni. There was not even a grain of salt. And there was no money to buy it. I decided to cook some macaroni, even without the accompanying ingredients and without the gas to cook. Of course, you know, gas bill was due. I gathered some crumpled papers and magazines to light a fire with. And I finally got the fire going, to boil the water that had the plain macaroni noodles in it. They'd been sitting around for a long time. And he says, I finally offered this quote-unquote delicacy to my wife and daughters. We all tried it. That's all we did. We did not swallow it. We tried, but the sick, slithery, tasteless mess would simply not go down. Now, a significant period of time continued to go on. They're always, where's the money for the rent? I don't know where we're going to get any decent food. You know? Always hungry. It was frustrating. But then he writes later on, and it's entitled, An End of Going Hungry. I have mentioned repeatedly how God brought me down, reduced to poverty and want, and how much we suffered hunger through all of those years. Much of the time in Astoria, up until about the time of the emergency trip to this one Helms farm to anoint someone, we had not enough to eat. I have explained in past chapters how, after conversion, I had to come and learn one doctrine at a time. The truth was not acquired all at once. I had known that the Bible had quite a bit to say about one's income, yet it had not been completely clear. At about this time, I had a little money I had from the work at the newspaper, and I made a special study, a thorough study of the subject of tithing. We saw the mistake that we had been making and started a definite and strict practice of tithing. We had only a very little on hand, but we sent in a tenth of it, plus an offering to the Oregon Conference treasurer. That day, the way opened up for us to be able to stock at home with reasonable abundance of food. For one thing, we had a large steak. My wife cooked it at low heat, and I'll never forget that steak. It was by far the best steak I ever tasted. Although we lived another 14 years in the barest and most modest financial of circumstances, we never from that day forward were hungry or missed meals because of financial poverty. We have since heard of scores and scores of cases and experiences of people who immediately prospered once they began tithing. He used the word prosper. Did he become a millionaire? No. But he felt that he was blessed. But we ourselves lived through the same experience, and I have been very grateful to have been instrumental to bring other countless people to the same divine blessing. But my wife and I had to learn it the, capital letters, hard way. The hard way. You might think, well, wait a minute. This is the one who became the apostle. This is the one that God was working with. He was already doing ministerial work. He was already thinking of already writing articles and defending the truth. And he was a champion for what was right. He was a tremendous leader. And he, if anybody would be ought to be blessed, it should be him and his wife. Look at the way they sacrificed. They stayed the course. Even when they were hungry, they didn't deviate. But they didn't know about tithing, and God did not give them a full blessing. God is not a respecter of persons. If Abraham didn't do it, then Abraham would have been eating the macaroni. You can't work against God. Now some people will say, in this society, well, how can you afford to do that? It's not easy. Inflation being what it is, unemployment rate, do we not have compassion for those that may be looking for work, those that are serious, those that would like to do better? And some of these people may be all working quite diligently. And God will see us all through. But this is an easier time than it would be back in the Great Depression years of the 1930s. And it worked out there. Now, one of the church members back in Oregon was married to a man who had no regard for the church for a while. And he would go around. He was a well driller. And when he would go see in the neighborhood past some of the brethren, he would chide them. He says, "Remember to pay your tithes. Remember to pay your tithes." Somebody says, "Why do you keep saying that? Do you?" He says, "Well, I don't have to. I'm not a Christian." So that the wife was concerned. And they were not doing any better than the rest of the neighborhood. And so, a surprise of surprises, somebody came up with $10, a huge amount of money back then, and gave it to the wife saying, "We owe you this for past work done." And so she told him about it and said, let's have nothing to lose, let's tithe on it. So she handed Mr. Armstrong a $1 bill. And then, lo and behold, somebody else surprised the wife and said, "Our family owes you $50 for a well that we never paid you for. And here it is." And so she tithed on that. She said, "I wouldn't have believed just a week ago when we were just struggling for pennies." And penny could buy, something back then. Now it was, she said, we had $54 to our name, more than some of our neighbors. And on top of that, we've donated $6 before that. We were able to do all of that. I had a relative lived in Colorado, and he was talking to me, wanted some money, talked to other family members, and there's a time to give and there's not a time to give, just like with everything else in life. And after talking, I finally asked him, "Do you tithe? What's that?" I said, "I think this is probably a good time to begin. You're at a crossroads. Now, you don't have to listen to me, you know. I'm just a relative. But I suggest that you find out now, not later when you might be inquisitive. Find out if God works in your life now, if He'll intervene." And so he decided to take me up on it. He was going to tithe. I said, "I don't care where you send the money, but give it to God in your frame of mind where you think it would be appropriate. I'll leave that up to you. But you need to know whether it's worth praying to God, if God is a liar, if God will come through." Now, he had a little bit of money, and he needed food. He didn't have a place to live. It was wintertime. He's living in his car. So if it snowed a couple feet, you know, he had to sweep it out. And it was holed up in a, you know, state park. And it wasn't really legal to be even in a place like that. You know, that's being down and out. You know, with no job, plenty of ideas, creativity, a lot of hustle, a lot of education, a lot of work, but not making the right choices, and this is where he was. And he had no regular source of income. So he decided, okay, I will tithe. And so we tithed on what a handful of money that he had, and then a little bit more came in. Then he had a yard sale. He made $40 on a Sunday afternoon. Then he had to come up with rent. The following Sunday, he made $100. And then the next Sunday, he said, "I was scared. I prayed to God and nothing happened. And I prayed some more and I prayed my heart out and nothing happened. And then the last hour of the day seemed like the whole neighborhood came in, gobbled everything up. I was sold out. Looked at an empty garage. Sold out. Had enough money for my rent." And then there was the next month. You know, what was I going to do? And nothing left to sell. And he was able to get two roommates. He says, "I prayed my guts out." He had, oh, I forgot to tell you. He was, during the winter, there was a couple that took pity on him and said, "You can live here rent-free until springtime." So that solved that problem. He had his own place. And then, when it was springtime, he ended up having enough money that he could move into a house with a person who was looking for a second person. That person ended up leaving him holding the rent responsibility. And so he said, "I prayed my guts out," and ended up with two roommates. They asked, "What's the rent going to be?" He said, $500 a month. And they thought, "That's dirt cheap for a house, to have part of a house. I'll snatch that up." But it turned out rent was about $1,000. So he was living there for free. He got those two to pay it. But it was the fact that he was getting the breaks instead of the curses. Things were falling in place. It wasn't a case of, if I get any money, I got seven places that I got to spend it at, and there's not enough money for everything, and I'm totally frustrated. It's always this way, and it's been this way, and it's never getting any better. You have to ask yourself the basic questions. You know the basics. Not everything is the health and wealth gospel. I can remember some car mechanics that were working on my vehicle, and they were thinking, "Oh, we can't understand it. We're checking it. I don't know why it doesn't start." Well, it wasn't my vehicle, but I was waiting for them to take care of that so that mine would be next. That's it. And they said, "Well, we've checked the gas line. We've looked at the valves. We've taken the carburetor apart. We can't understand why this thing doesn't run." And after an hour of troubleshooting, somebody says, "Well, does it have any gas?" The plant thing was empty. And it was like we wasted a whole hour of our existence on chasing the wind. So they put the gas in, and everything started right up. It was fine. You know, it's easy to wonder what's going wrong and overlook the obvious. Overlook the obvious. I need to conclude. There are numerous things that God would like to do for us, but it's so important that we do our part. Faith without works is dead. Works without faith is dead. God can make a difference. He wants to make a difference for us. And we realize that in the future, when there are challenges equal, if not greater, than what we see here, we have to know that God will do His part. We have to prove His existence. And this is as good a time as any. Not wait for the future, or wait until we're in a box canyon somewhere. Let's appreciate the fact that God, in any society, in any circumstance, can make things work. We had a church member that lived in Norway where the taxes were so exorbitant that if he were to do a regular tithe and the church had to make a decision for him, that if you added up his tithes and his taxes, it would exceed his income because of the socialistic arrangement of the governments of the Scandinavian nations. And he said, even though I didn't have a whole lot of discretionary money left to work with, he said, I noticed, and he lived out on an island, my outboard motor, on my motorboat that got me to the kids to school and me to work and everything, it just never wore out. My shoes, my wife's shoes, just never wore out, just continued. And it was like there was just a supernatural sustenance that kept him going, where he didn't really have a lot of money left over, but he didn't have to spend a lot of money. And that's the key. It's not what you make, it's what you have left over. And so he had what he needed, enough. And if we can live with the fact that probably most of us are not going to be billionaires in this life, if we can settle for the fact that we can have a future where we don't have to worry about food, we don't have to worry about having what we need, as long as we're responsible people, as long as we're trying, that God is there for us, that's peace of mind. That's a blessing. And we need that. And that may stick us out like sore thumbs among our relatives and other people that may be fretting. How do they cope? How do they manage? How are they unruffled by what's going on? It's because a great God in heaven who backs up His laws, that cannot lie, is in favor of intervening for us. So we can be thankful for that, thankful that the mystery continues, that we can have addition even with some subtraction. I hope that we have a deeper appreciation for this law of God. It is a principle that has worked for people regardless of their level of understanding of the Bible. And in some cases, it has worked quite dramatically. Whether or not we choose to take God at His word, Malachi 3, and believe what it says, the choice is up to us. Let's make that right choice.